From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, the story of the world's largest contraband weapons network and the man behind it, Victor Boot. He's armed civil wars, insurgencies, and homicidal strongmen around the world, sometimes supplying both sides in a conflict. The Taliban and Al-Qaeda have been his clients, but so has the U.S. His organization was contracted to fly weapons and supplies to the U.S. military and private contractors in Iraq. We'll talk with journalists Douglas Farah and Stephen Braun, authors of a new book about Boot called Merchant of Death. Also, the new Harry Potter film opened today, and our film critic David Edelstein has a review. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. This is the story of the world's preeminent contraband weapons dealer, Victor Boot. His global network of arms and planes has made a fortune catering to insurgencies, civil wars, and murderous strongmen around the world. His clients have included the Taliban and Islamist militias. Boot is Russian and built his network by taking advantage of the Soviet Union's collapse. In 2000, American intelligence officials designated Boot the highest-ranking international target other than the leaders of Al-Qaeda. Yet, his organization was contracted to fly weapons and supplies to the U.S. military and American private contractors in Iraq. My guests are journalists Douglas Farah and Stephen Braun, authors of a new book about Boot called Merchant of Death. Farah is the former West African bureau chief of the Washington Post and wrote a previous book about Al-Qaeda's financial network. Braun is a Pulitzer Prize-winning national correspondent for the L.A. Times. Douglas Farah, Stephen Braun, welcome back to Fresh Air. Let's start with a sense of the magnitude of Boot's weapons supply network, the kinds of wars and civil wars, invasions, insurgencies, terrorist groups that he's armed over the years.
Well, I think what makes Boot so remarkable is that he's armed just about everyone all around the world, from the FARC in Colombia to Charles Taylor in Liberia to Jonas Savimbi in Angola to the Taliban in Afghanistan, and working for Muammar Gaddafi out of Libya, flying into the Philippines for the Abu Sayyaf group. So it's a fairly large and very expansive network. At its peak, it had over 50 aircraft, and that's more than most national air forces have. So he was a character with considerable reach and great airlift capacity.
Did he have any politics or ideology behind who he arms, or has he sometimes armed both sides in a conflict?
He often armed all sides in the conflict. DRC, where you had several sides fighting, he was on every side. In Angola, he armed both the government and the UNITA rebels. In Afghanistan, he armed the Taliban as well as the Northern Alliance. Essentially, he was the most amoral, non-political purveyor of weapons, I think, that the world has ever seen. There seems to be no ideology at all to what he does. It's simply a money-making enterprise. And at the same time, he's flying for the United Nations. He's flying humanitarian missions. He's flying for the U.S. government. He's flying for the British government, all more or less simultaneously in a rather extraordinary display of complete open-mindedness as to who his clients might be.
Which I'm sure has made him a very wealthy man.
Indeed.
Perhaps what will be most interesting to Americans right now is the role that Victor Boot played in Iraq. What is that role?
Victor Boot's flights into Iraq started in mid-late 2003 and continued at least as late as the end of 2005. Hundreds of flights came in flying all sorts of military supplies, tents, personnel, oil equipment, you name it. And a number of airlines continued sort of shifting names. But he had a fairly central role in enabling the post-war military supply effort and reconstruction.
So, I mean, here he is, like, perhaps the world's biggest arms dealer. Who was contracting him? Was it the Pentagon? Was it private military contractors?
It was both. The Pentagon, through second, what they described as second tier and third tier contractors, private contractors the same way. In other words, there would be, for example, there was a big contract with FedEx for a period, and he did a lot of his planes did a lot of the flying for FedEx. But again, this is something where the government at least had the responsibility to at least know who was flying for them. And you got dozens of these contracts.
I think what's important to know is Halliburton and KBR were also among his largest contractors at the early part of that period when he was flying.
That's correct.
Was he surreptitious enough so that, like, when KBR or Halliburton hired him, they could say, well, oh, we had no idea it was a Victor Boot company. We just know it was, like, this company with another name. Who knew he was connected to it?
Well, here's the deal. I mean, his organization is much like a sort of international narcotics organization. It relied on entities that continually shifted their names, shifted their locations. But at the same time, by the time the Iraq War started, there was a lot open source information out there in which people knew about some of these companies. For example, there was a company named Air Bass that had already surfaced as a fairly well-known Boot flagship. Well, this company was flying openly into Baghdad during that period. It wouldn't have been very hard if government agencies that did the contracting for the Pentagon had done their homework. They would have known that this was his operation. Either they didn't care, or they decided that in fact he was their man.
Were Americans buying arms from him too, or just using his planes?
As far as we can determine, into Iraq, it was the aircraft. He the air freight capacity that he offered. And one of his other tricks, going back to the previous question, was that he knew that the air operators that were running the flights into Baghdad were operating essentially on 6-month rotations. And so by the time a new guy came in, figured out who Boot's new companies might be, tried to blackball them probably in the fifth or sixth month and left, he would simply re-register his companies, come back to the new flight controllers as a new company, and start again. And the pressure to get the goods in and out of Iraq was such and is such that it's very difficult for those people, in fairness, to monitor all this all the time. But the truth is they made no effort to do so.
Now, the Bush administration issued an order. Was this in 2004 or 2005?
July 2004 was the first executive order.
Yeah, describe what the order said.
The order said that because Boot had been deeply aligned and a critical partner to Charles Taylor in Liberia, no U.S. citizen or government entity could do business with Boot or any of his companies in any way, shape, or form under a Liberia executive order that went out at the time. Then in May of 2005, the official Treasury Department Office of Foreign Asset Control put out another list naming Boot again and 30 of his companies and several of his closest associates as being people who would have their assets frozen in the United States, and again saying that it is illegal to do business with them or any of their subsidiary companies in any way, shape, or form. And as Steve said, we documented through early January 2006, which is the full 7 months after the second order came out, way over a year after the first order came out, where they were still happily doing business illegally with him.
But after the Treasury Department froze, you know, wanted to freeze his assets in April of 2005, you say that the freeze was actually delayed. How come?
The implementation of the freeze was delayed because the military asked the Treasury Department to delay it because they were using Boot planes, and they knew they were using Boot planes at that point to fly in critically needed, they argued, weapons and other supplies. And so they asked the Treasury Department to please exempt them from punishment for breaking the Treasury Department ban so they could finish using him to bring in what they thought were critical, what they described as critical supplies.
I mean, what you had here was this fascinating arrangement where you had one branch of the government, in effect, saying anybody who does business with Victor Boot is subject to criminal sanctions, while another branch, the Defense Department, was enriching him to the tune of millions of dollars in U.S. Taxpayer money.
You know, you write in your book that in a world that President Bush starkly divides between those who are either with us or against us in the war on terror, that Victor Boot has become both. You know, he's armed Islamic terrorists, and at the same time, we've used him.
Well, I think that's one of the most fascinating things about this is when we trace Boot, his first known weapons deliveries in illegal circumstances were into Bosnia to radical Islamic militants fighting in the first Bosnian War in 1992. And then he carries over into the Taliban in the late 1990s. And as I say, the FARC in between there in Colombia, the Revolutionary Armed Forces of Colombia. And yet he was happily used by not only the U.S. government, you have to say the United Nations used him extensively. He would often fly relief supplies into war zones where he was arming both sides of the conflict. So talk about taking maximum advantage of a situation when you can arm both sides, create a disaster, and then make millions of dollars flying relief into the disaster you helped to create. It's a pretty spectacular way of viewing business opportunities.
My guests are journalist Douglas Farah and Stephen Braun, author of the new book, Merchant of Death. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guests are journalists Douglas Farah and Stephen Braun. They're the authors of the new book, Merchant of Death. And the book is about the Victor Boot Network. And Boot armed the Taliban, Al-Qaeda, African civil wars, insurgencies. He's the preeminent figure in the multi-billion-dollar illegal weapons trade. And his planes flew in supplies for Americans in Iraq. In January 2005, Paul Wolfowitz, who was then Deputy Secretary of Defense and had been an architect of the Iraq War, he acknowledged that there was an Iraqi connection to Boot, but he put it in a kind of roundabout way. He said, both the U.S. Army and the Coalition Provisional Authority did conduct business with companies that subcontracted work to second-tier providers who leased aircraft owned by companies associated with Mr. Boot. What is he saying there?
He's saying that they used Victor Boot's companies and they didn't want to admit they did it. This was in response to a letter from Senator Russell Feingold, who had asked questions in committee hearings about the use of Boot aircraft. And while the State Department answered almost immediately and then cut off all contact with Boot flights, the Pentagon dragged its answers out for many months, dragged the response time out for many months before answering at all. And when they did, they came back with this, and their explanation was essentially that they did not have to monitor who the people below their first-tier contractors were. In other words, they were not responsible for anything that might happen below the level of directly contracting Halliburton or FedEx or KBR.
In fact, it took them 9 months to answer, and in the intervening period, there was just utter silence from the DOD.
Do you have any estimate of the amount of money Victor Boot made working for American contractors and the military in Iraq?
It's hard to know, but we did learn that at least some of the flights that he contracted with private contractors went to the tune of around $60,000 or so, some more, some less. We know of upwards of 200 to 300 flights for certain that his various air firms flew in that period. But we've also heard estimates from others who are involved in the air cargo industry and worked in Iraq, that his firms may have flown as much as 1,000 flights over that period. If that's the case, you're looking at close to $60 million.
I mean, one of the fascinating things was that one of his companies, when it was flying into Iraq, was offered and given, with no questions asked, essentially a credit card that allowed them free U.S. Air Force or military fuel at any stop in Iraq. So not only were they paying him, they were giving him free aviation fuel to fly his flights for a period of time there. So he got really the best of all worlds.
So is Victor Boot still doing work in Iraq for Americans?
I doubt it at this point. I think it's become too politically costly for him unless he's radically restructured into companies that are even more difficult to fly. One of his distinguishing characteristics was the use of the same aircraft in different companies again and again. And now, especially the large cargo flights, the Ilyushin 76s and things, have been well enough identified that I think it would be difficult for him to continue to do that. And if it happened now, one would hope that there would be some criminal sanction imposed on those who were using him.
What's the status of the United States' efforts to close him down?
Well, they're essentially non-existent except for a small group of people in the Treasury Department. There's no one left in the U.S. intelligence community, either in the military or the CIA, who are dedicated full-time to Victor Boot. This changed a little bit in the Eastern Horn of Africa when the Somali conflict was blowing up late last year and into this year, because they tracked the flights bringing weapons into the Islamic court unions, the radical Islamist groups that were fighting for control of Somalia directly back to Boot, and that sparked off a large scale investigation in the Horn of Africa, the Joint Task Force in the Horn of Africa that's monitoring that. But essentially, aside from when he's on their radar screen causing direct havoc in an area where the U.S. has critical interests, there's very little effort left.
Did his people try to intimidate you when you were breaking this story?
They were aware over time of some of our sources and went after them in rather unpleasant ways. There's one particular case where they made life particularly difficult for one person who had been one of his inside people in Liberia, and made him and his girlfriend pay. We don't know the ultimate fate of what happened to them, but they were they're no longer available to us to talk to. Us directly know one of his associates, Richard Cichocli, who's an American Syrian citizen who worked with him extensively, has set up a blog essentially to attack us and say what liars and fabricators we are. But I think that at this point, that's the extent of what we've experienced.
Right. Just as a point as well, Cichocli is one of the associates who was also named in the Treasury order. And soon after his assets were frozen, he left the country and showed up in Moscow and for a while in Syria, but he essentially is attacking us and OFAC, the Treasury people, and the Bush administration from abroad.
Well, my favorite part of that story, though, is after the United States froze Cichocli's assets, he flew to Moscow with a frequent flyer ticket.
Yes, well, he couldn't get any money because his assets were frozen, and he had an account in overseas where he flew to in Egypt and collected the money there, and then went on to Moscow, and then went to Damascus for a period of time, and is now apparently back in Moscow where he maintains fairly cordial relations with Victor Boot.
Let's go back to the beginning of this story. Victor Boot basically filled a vacuum at the end of the Cold War. He's Russian. What was the vacuum he filled when the Cold War ended?
Well, when the Cold War ended, the former Soviet Union had extensive arms pipelines that ferried materiel through favorite rebel movements and their favored dictators in Africa and elsewhere in the Third World. When the Soviet Union communism began to collapse, those pipelines still existed. There were personnel who were involved in them. There was money behind them, but there was no longer an ideology behind them. So what replaced them was this new sort of capitalistic movement, if you will. And people stepped into the fore and began to realize that a lot of those movements were still clamoring for Eastern European arms. And as a result of that, what Victor Boot pioneered was this melding of the enormous weapons inventory that the Soviet Union and the Eastern Bloc had, and this incredible air force, airplanes that were just sitting idle at airports throughout Russia, just waiting to be used.
In a sense, I think it was the perfect storm for him, because there were aircraft that couldn't fly because they didn't have any gasoline, money for maintenance or fuel, and weapons supplies guarded by people who were no longer receiving salaries. And so with a little bit of money, you could get the system working again, going to people, as Steve said, who are still clamoring for the weapons. So he had easy access to aircraft, which was vital, especially in Africa, where there's no other way to move large quantities of goods and weapons. And he had access to the weapons, and many of these weapons factories in throughout the Soviet bloc have airstrips directly in the storage area. So you could land there. It's essentially door-to-door service. You could land there, load up, and door-to-door deliver to Charles Taylor or Jonas Savimbi or anyone else you wanted to. And so it was very efficient, and he could sell, at least initially, at below market cost, because all he had to do was pay the guards to let him load up the AKs onto his aircraft and fly out. He didn't have to pay market value for what those AKs were. And it was this perfect combination of events. And what people say who worked with him was that lots of people were looking at this, and he was the only one who saw the opportunities and sort of seized them and ran. And we traced his first things to 1992, his first sales, and that was right as right after the wall came down. He was 25 years old at the time. He was a pretty smart guy.
So was he able to get access to planes and ammunition just by bribing people?
Well, he used whatever means necessary. A number of Russian acquaintances suggested that he moved money around to get access to planes. But in many cases, you have to understand, these planes were essentially reduced to scrap. In one celebrated case, there was an airplane that was about to be consigned and used as a monument in a small Soviet town, suddenly disappeared. And the reason that it disappeared was that it ended up in Victor Boot's flotilla and was soon flying for him back and forth on all kinds of circuits. So he did what he had to. And these planes came incredibly cheaply, and he used whatever means necessary to get hold of them. And, by the mid to late 1990s, he had 60-odd Antonovs, Ilyushins, flying these circuits all throughout the Third World.
But he also had backing from remnants of the Soviet military intelligence establishment, which is where he came out of. And it's clear that he had protection from those people while he moved this. And he probably, at least in the early days, was sharing profits with a group of people who could give orders to allow him into certain military bases and facilitate his access to the aircraft that he might not otherwise have had.
Douglas Farah and Stephen Braun will be back in the second half of the show. Their new book about weapons dealer Victor Boot is called Merchant of Death. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Support for NPR comes from Barnes & Noble, publishers of the Classics edition of The Federalist, papers by Hamilton, Madison, and Jay, in stores and online at bn.com. And from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, helping to build a more just future for the nation and the world at macfound.org. CDs and transcripts of Fresh Air are available from Burrell's Loose at 1-877-21-FRESH. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, more on how Victor Boot built his arms network by exploiting the Soviet Union's collapse, and David Edelstein reviews the new Harry Potter film. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. We're talking about the Russian arms dealer Viktor Boot, who built a huge illegal international network supplying civil wars, insurgencies, militias, and murderous strongmen around the world. The U.S. has been his client, too. Boot's network flew weapons and supplies to the U.S. military and American private contractors in Iraq. My guests are journalists Douglas Farah and Stephen Braun, authors of a new book about Boot called Merchant of Death. Boot is Russian and built his network after the collapse of the Soviet Union. Now, how has Boot dealt with his rivals in the contraband weapons world?
Well, he at various times he has cut deals and worked with others. You have to remember what he has that few others have is, while most other arms dealers basically they can source the arms, cut the deal, maybe provide the illegal documents that allow them to get from point A to point B. What he can do is he has this, essentially it's a full service operation, where he not only can help source the arms and the documents, but he moves them. If you're an arms dealer, you ultimately often have to work with him to get those arms to the place where you need them to go. So, at times he'll work with them, at times they'll be rivals. It's a business where alliances are constantly breaking apart and solidifying and then breaking apart again.
But there are very few instances where anyone talks about him getting violent or going after his opposition in a physical sense. He does co-opt them in. And it's clear in the early days in Africa, he was not the biggest player, but he became the biggest player, like Steve said, because he had the aircraft to do it. But he essentially just brought people into his operation or ran them out of business by taking away their customers. But he doesn't have a lot of blood on his hands directly in the business competition sense.
So one of the places where he established an important base was in the United Arab Emirates. And one of his tricks in making money was, after he'd drop off a load of guns, he'd load up with commodities to sell someplace else.
That was when he moved from being sort of an arms trafficker and working for other people to making significant money, was when he realized that was the potential that existed. And so you see him flying into the Democratic Republic of Congo and loading up on coltan, which is a mineral that's used in making cell phones and computers, and loading up with timber, loading up out of Angola and Liberia with diamonds, and also flying food, frozen fish, frozen chicken, sort of anything that needed to be moved, he could move. And once he figured out that no plane ever needed to fly empty in Africa, that's when his financial fortunes took a great surge forward.
He's kind of like Milo Minderbinder, the character in Catch-22, who wherever he takes planes that were being used on bombing runs, and they come back and they're filled with eggs or Egyptian cotton. But essentially what he masterminded was these circuits where his planes would fly, for example, out of Belgium, where they had a base for a while, and then they'd stop in Bulgaria, and they would pick up an arms shipment, and they'd fly into Africa, and then they'd leave Africa with perhaps as Doug was saying, coltan or chickens or whatever. And then they might stop in the UAE, fly out with some other cargo. It could be arms, could be whatever. Land in Afghanistan and fly out of there with, say, lumber or carpets. On each circuit, he was making money, and that's the object of a good air cargo man.
When you look at a civil war or an insurgency, can you look at the arms being used and tell if those arms came from Viktor Boot's network?
Well, you can't tell the direct numbers usually, because it's incredibly difficult to trace, and most of the weapons are fairly old. But what you can do in Liberia and Sierra Leone and in the Congo is look at the upsurges in fighting and track those very closely with the deliveries that we know Viktor Boot was making. For example, 98-99 in Sierra Leone, the Revolutionary United Front, whose signature atrocity was hacking off the arms and legs of men, women, and children, and the mass rape of women as a weapon of control, they take take off when Victor Boot starts delivering weapons to them. And you can look at chronologically, they match up very closely. They had one of their major operations was called Operation Pay Yourself, where they essentially looted the Capitol. They had a series of horrific operations that really decimated the human cost of those, which I was witnessing when I was covering Sierra Leone for the Washington Post, is really devastating. And that you can track directly with his weapons deliveries.
Do you feel some kind of like personal connection to him and a personal interest in covering his network because you covered wars in which he supplied a lot of the arms and he made some of that mayhem and catastrophe possible?
Well, I would say yes, honestly. I covered wars in Central America and elsewhere for 20 years, but there was nothing that carried the emotional impact of the wars in Sierra Leone and in Liberia, where I think you have the use of child soldiers extensively, knowing that those weapons came from him, and the types of atrocities and the absolute ruthlessness of the rebel groups, particularly in Sierra Leone. And if you look at their main sponsor, who was Charles Taylor in Liberia, the destructive nature of those wars and spending time in the amputee camps with you know, 2-year-old children who have their arms lopped off because some crazed teenager was given a gun and told to go do this is emotionally quite difficult. And it did give me a sense that I really wanted to bring about some sort of explanation for how this system works and why people like Victor Boot not only survive but thrive as well.
Right, and it's not, you have to remember, it's not simply Victor Boot operating alone in a world that's arrayed against him. There are, you know, obviously governments, it is in their interest not to have him around, but at the same time, it's also been in their interest at various times to use him. So all of the governments, including ours, bear a responsibility here in allowing him to continue to flourish.
You know, there have been times when he's flown humanitarian missions, you know, when his network has. For example, he flew humanitarian aid to the tsunami victims. He flew UN relief supplies for refugees during African conflicts that he was actually arming. Like, why would he do that? Does he want to have the image of a good guy? Does it help preserve his cover? Does it help win over people who would otherwise be his enemies? Like, what's his motivation?
Well, I mean, remember, all of those flights, he's making money.
Right.
I mean, he's not doing
Excuse
this.
Excuse me. Yeah.
He's not doing this to be a world class altruist. But certainly there he can point to those flights with a certain amount of pride and say, well, I was part of that. I've aided these charity operations. But he also uses those the few times he has spoken in public. You know, he insists that, number one, he's a businessman, but number two, he, has worked for legitimate governments and has participated in these operations. Why, then do the United States at various times, the UN at various times, why are these organizations out to get him? It plays well into his own excuses and arguments.
My guests are journalists Douglas Farah and Stephen Braun, authors of the new book Merchant of Death. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guests are journalists Douglas Farah and Stephen Braun, authors of a new book about the world's preeminent contraband arms dealer, Victor Boot. The book is called Merchant of Death, Money, Guns, Planes, and the Man Who Makes War Possible. Why has it been so difficult to stop Victor Boot's arms network?
Well, I think because it goes in so many different directions and because he does provide a vital service in certain areas that are would be difficult to, where other people have difficulty operating. And like you said, the tsunami relief. And if you wanted to fly into Afghanistan right after the 9/11 attacks in the United States, whose pilots had the only working knowledge of the functioning airstrips in Afghanistan because they've been flying in and out of there for years? Well, it was unfortunately Victor Boot's people. If you wanted people who were willing to take risks and fly into dangerous situations in Iraq with airplanes who could withstand the really bumpy and unfinished runways there, U.S. planes couldn't do it. You needed old Antonovs that could stand up to that sort of beating. And who had them? Victor Boot. If you want to fly into the jungle airstrips of, you know, Angola, who's available? Well, Victor Boot is. And so in my assessment, it's the complete immorality of what he's willing to do that allows him to flourish. Because he will work with governments as well as every bad guy around who can pay him, he's made himself indispensable in the world weapons market and other markets. The reliefs, the moving of UN peacekeepers, all of those things. He's just done it, spread himself so broadly and so well that he's too valuable to too many people to really be put out of business.
You write that you think that only the Russians can really stop him. Why?
Well, because he is a creature of that society and of that system. And as long as he's useful to them, they will keep him going because he provides them with a lot of opportunities. And if you look at the conflict between Hezbollah and Israel last year, you have a huge amount of new Russian weapons showing up in the hands of Hezbollah, the new armor-piercing missiles that they were using in things. And Russia has other strategic interests that diverge sharply from what the U.S. interests are around the world. And I think you'll see them increasingly showing up on other sides of conflicts again. And Boot is incredibly useful there. But he's under the protection of groups in Moscow, and no one is going to go in and get him unless the Russians let that happen. And so far, there's no indication that that will happen.
Right. They had an opportunity in 1992 when the Belgians indicted him. They issued an arrest warrant and sent him through Interpol.
That was 2002.
2002. There was an opportunity then, and the Russian government declined to make him available to the Belgians.
Well, not only did they decline to make him available, they declared flatly that he was not on Russian territory when he was giving an interview two blocks from the Interpol office in Moscow for 2 hours, a two-hour live interview, while explaining his take on the world and how he was innocent of all charges, while the Interpol notice went out saying that he was not on Russian territory. So there's a bit of a dysfunctionality there.
You mentioned that Richard Clark, when he was working for the National Security Council, saw Boot as a real problem and wanted to shut down his network. When the Bush administration came to the White House, Clark told Condoleezza Rice about the importance of shutting down Boot and saw her as an ally, and she acted like an ally, but then you say the Bush administration kind of lost interest in Boot.
Well, essentially, yes, and that was, I think, largely due to 9/11. Condoleezza Rice is a Soviet expert, and they did a presentation for her, one of the first presentations she got as National Security Advisor to President Bush was an array of satellite photographs taken of Victor Boot's aircraft lined wing to wing on the airstrips in United Arab Emirates where he was operating, and she expressed a real desire to move forward with this. The NSC was supposed to be preparing a major briefing for the principals to go after Victor Boot, and it was scheduled for September 11th, 2001, and then that briefing never took place.
One of the things I find really frightening about the whole Victor Boot story is that, okay, the Cold War ends, and he's able to bribe people and so on, to do what he needs to do, to take advantage of all these old weapons and old planes that are just kind of hanging around the Soviet Union. So what does that mean about another really kind of smart, ambitious, underground person and all the nuclear weapons that are hanging around the Soviet Union?
That's the great peril that a number of members of the Clinton administration, Clark and some of his aides and some folks in the intelligence community worried about as well, was that to get that material moving, you need some sort of dispersal, some sort of logistic system that would do it. And people like Lee Wolosky, who was the man that Clark picked to go after Boot. These are the things that Wolosky and others worry greatly about, was that what Boot provided not only was this dispersal of arms, but he had a worldwide logistics operation unrivaled by any other group, and he was basically willing to work for the highest payer. And the concern was that Boot's operation could potentially do that. They've never been able to definitively link his operation with nuclear materials, but there was a period certainly in the late 90s, early 2000s when there was real concern.
Do you know who Boot is arming now?
Well, the U.S. military believes he was arming the Somali Islamist groups in the recent fighting. The Israelis say they have a strong, good sighting of him, confirmed sighting of him in Lebanon during the fighting between Hezbollah and in Israel last summer. So he doesn't appear to have retired out of any business, and he is reportedly shown up in South Africa again in the not too distant past in the last several months. He seems to operate between Cyprus, Moldova, and obviously Russia, where he lives in Moscow. He's under a UN travel sanction, which means the UN has put out a list saying these particular people are not allowed to travel outside of their home countries. But that doesn't seem to stop him. We documented at least five passports that he had at one time, and he probably has many more now. So he's able to travel relatively unimpeded.
Let me ask you what will sound like a simplistic question, but what is the moral of the Victor Boot story?
I think the moral of the Victor Boot story is that the world has changed very, very quickly, and the methods of keeping up with terrorists and financial criminal networks and weapons delivery systems have changed virtually not at all. And we are decades behind in understanding how the New World Order operates. We don't understand criminal networks. Our intelligence community is still woefully short on human intelligence, and we have yet to define in critical ways what our strategic interests are where. And I think there's these great gaps in knowledge where we still look at the world as it was in 1945 or 1965 are going to catch up with us in very serious ways, and already have through the networks that Victor Boot has armed in different parts of the world where we do have strategic interests. And I think our inability to come to grips with how quickly the world has changed in the growing dominance of non-state armed actors around the world, people who no longer respond to state pressure, is one of the critical issues of our time that we're simply not equipped to deal with yet.
You've done a lot of work researching Victor Boot's network of arms and planes and how he's armed conflicts around the world and even flown in supplies to Iraq on behalf of the American military and American contractors. Most people have never heard of him, and I guess I'm wondering why you think his network isn't a bigger story, particularly his network's connection or former connection in Iraq.
Well, I think part of it is that the war on terror has just sort of sucked up all of the, the oxygen. And so when we look at the world, we tend to look at it in terms of terrorism, and we rarely look at the structure that aids in some cases that terrorist effort. But also, it's in a broader sense, we don't. In Africa, for example, as it always been, both in terms, at least through the 1990s, was sort of a secondary impulse of both the White House and to a degree, a journalist as well. I think now it's sort of incumbent on us to look beyond the terrorism filter and try to understand what these systems and how these systems aid those movements.
Well, I want to thank you both very much for talking with us. Thank you.
Thank you, Terry.
Thank you very much.
Douglas Farah and Stephen Braun are the authors of Merchant of Death. Farah is the former West African bureau chief of the Washington Post. Braun is a Pulitzer Prize-winning national correspondent for the LA Times. Coming up, our film critic David Edelstein reviews the new Harry Potter film. This is Fresh Air. Harry Potter and the Order of the Phoenix is the fifth film to be made from J.K. Rowling's blockbuster series of books about an orphaned boy wizard, his magical prep school, and his evil nemesis, Lord Voldemort. The film opens only 10 days ahead of a major publishing event, Rowling's conclusion to the saga. Film critic David Edelstein has a review of the latest Harry Potter movie.
As the mania builds for the seventh and last book in J.K. Rowling's Harry Potter series, the question hangs, will Harry get whacked? 10 days ahead of its release comes the fifth movie, Harry Potter and the Order of the Phoenix, which douses the final embers of childish wonder. Here is a landscape of sexual frustration, madness, fascism, and death. This is not a family movie. It's not even gothic horror like the last Potter movie, The Chilling Goblet of Fire. Order of the Phoenix is practically Orwellian. The palette is grainy and dank. The face is gray. The hero's alienation, festering. It's quite a change from director Christopher Columbus's Christmassy first movie, Harry Potter and the Sorcerer's Stone, which hardly began to suggest the pagan energy and anger out of which Rowling's series was born. The books have been slammed by literary poobahs like Harold Bloom, but I love their balance between enchantment and dread. Order of the Phoenix is in some ways an improvement over Rowling's novel, which is mired in Harry's angst and builds to a climactic wand-off better ogled than read. That climax is an eye-popper. The director, David Yates, made the great British miniseries State of Play, a literate newspaper drama with a vein of sublimated violence. Here, he lets loose with horrific montages to evoke his hero's estrangement. A fixture in Harry's nightmares is Lord Voldemort, played by Ralph Fiennes, his features primordially puttyish. Hogwarts headmaster Dumbledore, played by Michael Gambon, has turned frosty and elusive. The oddly paranoid Ministry of Magic has mounted a campaign through its Pravda-like newspaper to discredit the notion of the Dark Lord's return from limbo, along with Harry's credibility. Above all, Harry Potter and the Order of the Phoenix is dominated by Imelda Staunton, best known for Mike Leigh's Vera Drake, overacting gleefully as the latest and most blood-curdling defense against the dark arts teacher Dolores Umbridge. A stand-in for the ministry, she meets out ghastly punishment with a smile of mocking gentility and palpably loathes her students' youth and freedom.
Your previous instruction in this subject has been disturbingly uneven. But you'll be pleased to know, from now on, you will be following a carefully structured, ministry-approved course of defensive magic.
Yes. There's nothing in here about using defensive spells.
Using spells? Well, I can't imagine why you would need to use spells in my classroom.
We're not going to use magic.
You will be learning about defensive spells in a secure, risk-free way.
Well, what use is that? If we're going to be attacked, it won't be risk-free.
Students will raise their hands when they speak in my class. It is the view of the ministry that a theoretical knowledge will be sufficient to get you through your examinations, which, after all, is what school is all about.
And how's theory supposed to prepare us for what's out there?
There is nothing out there, dear. Who would you imagine wants to attack children like yourself?
Oh, I don't know. Maybe Lord Voldemort.
The movie irons out a few of Rowling's intriguing dissonances, among them the morbidity of Harry's godfather Sirius Black, played by Gary Oldman. It also doesn't solve the problem of Harry's beloved, Cho Chang, played by Katie Leung, still a cipher, even in the course of a smooch with Harry heard round the world. But there is a marvelous turn by a young actress new to movies, Ivana Lynch, as the queerly introverted Luna Lovegood. This flake flutes her lines, but not always on key. The supporting cast is the usual embarrassment of British riches, plus Helena Bonham Carter as a cackling she-demon. Among the standbys, Alan Rickman as the supercilious Snape barely opens his mouth. The lines wheeze out like the low bass of a bellows. The central trio, Daniel Radcliffe's Harry, Emma Watson's Hermione, and Rupert Grint's Ron, is now on the far side of puberty, which makes me a little sad, but there's no stopping the wheel. Their aging brings thoughts of their mortality. Having confidently proclaimed that David Chase would not kill off Tony Soprano too early, I'm loath to predict what the final Potter book will bring. But Order of the Phoenix has me worried. How can Harry defeat everything murderously repressive in the world without making the ultimate sacrifice?
David Edelstein is film critic for New York Magazine. If you want to catch up on programs you've missed, you can download podcasts of our show by going to our website, freshair.npr.org. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Bob Purdick. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Roberta Sherrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for NPR comes from 20th Century Fox Home Entertainment, presenting the independent film Sweet Land, starring Elizabeth Reaser and Tim Guinea, on DVD today. From the Horace W. Goldsmith Foundation, supporting the Museum of Modern Art in Midtown Manhattan, information at moma.org. And from the Kauffman Foundation, featuring the book Good Capitalism, Bad Capitalism, and the Economics of Growth and Prosperity, at kauffman.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
The war between Israel and Hezbollah started 1 year ago. On the next Fresh Air, we discuss unintended consequences of that war with Timur Gakzel, former spokesperson and senior advisor for the United Nations peacekeeping force in Lebanon. He now teaches at the American University of Beirut. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.